Should we begin?
Yes, let's go ahead and begin. Now, this is Father Marcus Birch. He's the priest of St. John the Latter Orthodox Church here in Greenville.
And I just thought.
I'm very nervous, as you can see. it's really my joy to be here this evening, and I'm grateful for Professor Stolting's invitation to Archbishop Alexander to come and present to you all. We understand that you're going to be going to Greece, and just a little bit of Vladika Alexander's background. He is a bishop of the Orthodox Church. He was born and raised in the Orthodox faith from California. He was a professor for 23 years at Marquette University in the Department of Theology. And he is I guess technically speaking, in addition to being a bishop and archbishop of the Orthodox Church, he is a monk of Simona Petra Monastery on Mount Athos, where he was tonsured a monastic, so he has a connection with Greece and certainly with the monasticism of Mount Athos. And really your academic work, although it's broader than this, but you have done a particular work in Dionysius the Areopagite, and sometimes called Pseudo-Dionysius,
right,
I guess.
But not by me.
Without further ado, I introduce you all to Archbishop Alexander, who is the Bishop of Dallas and the Diocese of the South.
Thank you.
Thank you for
I gather I was asked to say something about church architecture. I'm not a student of architecture, but I can say something about the theological background, say, of an Orthodox Church as you find it today and for the last 1,500 years or more. And my talk will revolve around two notions. One is the tradition around tabernacle and temple in the Old Testament. And the second is a kind of principle enunciated first, I think, by the Stoics back in pre-Christian Greece. The notion of microcosm and macrocosm. Along the way, we'll touch on liturgy and the spiritual tradition of the Orthodox Church, by which is meant essentially the monastic tradition, since our spirituality, not a word I much like, I have to say, but I'll use it since it's roughly familiar. Our spirituality is essentially that of the monks. From their very first appearance in the Christian world in the 4th century, although they had antecedents, I think, going back into the beginnings, and even before the beginnings, into pre-Christian Israel, they have been regarded as the exemplars, you could say, of maximal Christian life. There's questions about it. We have time at the end. See if we can get to it a little bit later. For now, let me turn to the first thing up on the board, tabernacle and temple. And referring you back to the Holy Scriptures, most notably the book of Exodus. Have any of you ever tried to read the Bible through from beginning to end? Okay, I tried it. My first attempt, I was a freshman. And Genesis went pretty well, All kinds of nice stories, right? The adventures of Joseph and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And then the first half of Exodus, that did pretty well, too. There was Pharaoh and Moses and plagues and Red Seas and armies and drownings and all kinds of good stuff. And then about 60% of the way through Exodus, I hit a wall. Where there were these chapters and chapters on cubits and kinds of wood and the sorts of colors of yarn that he used. Just stupefied. And that was where my first attempt stopped. And some years later, I managed to slog all the way through that and Leviticus, which certainly wasn't any better. later on. Well, interestingly, the attitude of most Old Testament scholars who write, certainly the ones who were writing that we had to read as seminarians, is pretty much the same. That's all that incredibly dull priest stuff that has no possible relevance now, certainly to Christians, because after all, Jesus died on the cross, and that's the end of all the cult of Israel. But it wasn't the attitude of the ancient church. The ancient Christian writers, I'm thinking especially of one 4th century writer, Gregory of Nyssa, who wrote A Life of Moses. He was maybe the most subtle and profound of the theologians who wrote in Greek in his day. He spends half his book on Moses, on those very chapters. That stupefied me. And likewise, the ancient rabbis, the ones who compiled the Talmud, the basis of contemporary Judaism, they can't get enough of it, those chapters. Why? Well, it comes out basically, if you remember the setting, you know, Moses has been up and down the mountain a couple of times, poor guy, he's always going up or coming down. And he's up there for the third time, I think. And they've done the business of the covenant, you know, that's all over now. They did that. Then they had brunch with God in chapter 24. You know, Moses and the elders, they saw the God of Israel and ate and drank.
Yes.
Up in the mountain. And then he goes up into the mountain again, and he's there 40 days and 40 nights. And while he's up there, God's at the start, in Exodus 25, verse 9. God says, okay, Moses, we've done the covenant bit and all that. Now I want you to make a sanctuary for me, that I may dwell with my people. And you will make it in every detail according to the pattern that I show you. And the pattern is, well, then there come those incredibly dull chapters. Wood and cubits and yarn. The question is, what did he mean by pattern? Not much of a question, actually, for us. I think we automatically assume, most of us nowadays, that the pattern is a kind of blueprint. It's like an engineer's sketch of a building to be, or a house. But that's not how they understood it in the ancient world. And when they came to translate Exodus from Hebrew into Greek, which was some centuries before Christ, they chose an interesting word. They chose the Greek word paradigm. According to the paradigm that I show you. And it's an interesting word because it was an important word for the philosopher Plato. Anybody remember? Anybody know anything about Plato? And his philosophy? Who doesn't? There. Well, you've heard the name, right?
Yeah.
But, what did he say? You know, he had the notion of ideas, yes, or forms. And the forms exist not here on this
realm of change, but are eternal and unchanging in a kind of supra-earthly realm. And everything that is down here is a kind of muddied reflection of the eternal and unchanging above. Now, the translators of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek, they were all Jews, probably living in Alexandria, a big Greek city on the Nile mouth. They probably knew something of that. So that word may carry a certain extra freight. But we know for certain that 200 years or so before Christ, this word pattern was understood. We know it from sources like the Dead Sea Scrolls, from the category that's called by Old Testament scholars Old Testament pseudepigrapha. These are all the books that didn't make it into the Old Testament. There are two thick volumes of them. You can get in English, cheap, $20, I think. Double column, fine print, 1,000 pages each. Word in the Bible, actually. Huge library. And one last note about that library. It was preserved almost exclusively by Christians. Jews, it fell out of use. The rabbis were much better censors than the bishops were. Bishops wanted to not copy them, but it was unsuccessful. They were copied in monasteries, probably, primarily, right into the 18th and 19th centuries in Russia. So they were valuable for Christians. Why? Well, that might come to that down the line. But we know from these sources that by 200 years before Christ, this pattern was understood almost universally as signifying that God had shown Moses the heavenly original of that which he was asking him to build on earth, a copy on earth. So, certainly by the time of Christ, and for some, at least a couple of centuries before Christ, if you read the Epistle to the Hebrews in the New Testament, it's all built on this idea. The heavenly temple. Or the book of Revelation. From chapter 4 on in that book, the end of the New Testament, all the action starts in the heavenly holy of holies. So you could say that certainly by the time of Christ, it is well established in the Jewish world that the worship in the temple, except for sacrifice, that was understood as not heavenly, and an adaptation to our sinfulness, but except for sacrifice, the worship at the temple was an image of what occurred in heaven. Now that tradition, I believe, carries on in the Christian world. I would cite, although I have very little by way of textual evidence in the first 300 years, aside maybe from books like Revelation, which some scholars have suggested is based on Christian liturgy, Christian worship. You know all the singing that happens in chapters 4, 5, and 6, all these antiphonal choirs, angels, elders, well, first one chorus, then the other, then together. I used to have that in my classes, do that, back and forth. When Christians do get the opportunity to build churches, which of course, as you know, wasn't until the 4th century, because Christianity was forbidden in the Roman Empire, and so they had to worship kind of quietly. They usually weren't bothered. It was only when some outside crisis, like a famine or a plague, popped up that they got in trouble with the locals. But they had to do it discreetly. Well, when the Emperor Constantine decided he was a Christian, then they could do it openly. And we get our first Christian buildings in the 4th century, at least the first ones that we know for sure about, of which we have remnants. And our earliest commentary on a Christian church comes to us from the 330s. It's a sermon by a bishop in Palestine named Eusebius. Eusebius of Caesarea. And it's on the consecration of the huge church that they had just finished building in the city of Tyre on the Lebanese coast. Now, from his description of the building, we can tell that it was pretty, ordinary for Roman times. It was a basilica, which just meant a public meeting hall, built for, large city events, with a raised platform at the end and a chair for the magistrate to sit in and preside. But the language that Eusebius uses to describe this very ordinary Roman architectural construct, the language is that of the temple. He describes the porch. The temple, if you might recall, and the tabernacle in Exodus, and the temple is described in the first book of Kings, kind of like Gaul in Caesar's commentaries, is divided into three parts. There's an outer kind of open porch, then an area, cubits by 10 cubits, something like that. Cubit is about 15 feet, or 15 inches, or 30, I forget, 40?
No, I forget.
40 cubits by, and 15 across, or 45 and 15 across, something like that. It's a rectangle. Okay. And then third part is this cube, 15 by 15 by 15, that is the Holy of Holies. And it's marked by a door, which is kept covered with a curtain. And inside, according to, in the tabernacle, it's the Ark of the Covenant, carrying the jars of manna and Aaron's rod. And on the top, on the lid of the ark, you've all seen Indiana Jones, right? I mean, it's a little... I don't think Spielberg has a sense of the numinous, but it's certainly your classic Child's Illustrated Bible ark. The cherubim, the winged beings, with wings meeting above the lid, and they're a part of the lid. Sidebar. The Hebrew word for this lid of the ark is kaporet, which is not the word I want to stress, but rather its Greek translation, which is elasterion, literally meaning the place of reconciliation. And in Old English, like the King James, this Greek word is usually translated with the phrase mercy seat. The mercy seat. That is, the lid of the ark was understood as the throne, the divine throne. The presence of God was, as it were, seated above the ark. On the wings of the cherubim, you've heard the psalm verse, you who ride on the wings of the cherubim, or the vision of Ezekiel, in chapter 1 of the prophet. That prophet, that's kind of the Copperet writ large. And that's become alive. This vision of the cherubim and the throne, carrying the throne. And I dwell on that a little bit because the sidebar is for the purpose of noting that first that St. Paul in Romans refers to Christ as the elasterion, the place of reconciliation, the mercy seat, the place of the divine presence. And second, because if you walk, when you go to Greece, you will find every Orthodox church that you come across built according to this plan. There will be a porch, a nave, that is, in fact, every Christian church up until, well, maybe especially the 70s, which was a disaster for church architecture. They got infected with kind of communitarian notions and forgot all this stuff entirely. But up until then, in both East and West, certainly in the Middle Ages, the Antiquity, the Middle Ages, right into the Renaissance and Counter-Reformation, churches are built according to this plan. A church is a temple. As one ancient Christian writer in Syria put it in a polemic against the contemporary Jews, you only have one temple and it's gone. And we have temples everywhere. Meaning that what you regarded rightly as unique and special, the dwelling place of God, now has multiplied throughout the earth and among the Gentiles. And that is the work of Messiah. That was kind of St. Paul's argument, that in Messiah, the boundaries that had enclosed Israel had been expanded to include the nations. But the worship seems always to have had this notion of the service as an image of heaven, a real communication of God with his people and a real presence of God among his people as God to Moses on Sinai. Now, secondly, the second notion I have up there, the microcosm and macrocosm. In the ancient philosophy of the Stoa, every human being was a miniature of the universe. The microcosm, the little world, a mirror of the great world. Now, that was the basis actually of Stoic ethics, which were profoundly influential for early Christianity. Stoic elements are all over the place, for example, in the ethical teachings of the New Testament. And this notion of the microcosm applies both, reflecting the macrocosm, the greater world, applies both to the spiritual life, which I'll come to in a moment, but also to the church life. I said an image, the liturgy is understood as an image of heaven. And gradually the church architecture comes to reflect this more and more consciously. We started out, as I noted with Eusebius, with simple copying of Roman architectural forms for public meetings. But gradually, the life and experience, the worship and theology of the church begins to affect the architecture. We see this maybe earliest in Syria, where, as I understand, although I'm not an expert, the earliest Christian churches we have in Syria reflect exactly the temple form, with, in fact, the wall between the
sanctuary where the altar is, doubling for the Holy of Holies, and the nave, the holy place. We can see this thinking also reflected in one of the earliest descriptions we have of a major Christian feast involving baptism, notably the Paschal Vigil, the Easter midnight service, when those who were preparing for baptism were baptized. And there's a wonderful description of it by a Spanish nun named Egeria, who's touring the holy places and the Holy Land and writing back to the girls at home in Spain with a description, a very ample description, an important one because it's unique. We don't have anything else like that from the period. And she's describing Easter, the Easter vigil at Jerusalem, the great church of the Holy Sepulchre that had been built by Emperor Constantine's mom, St. Helen. And she describes this scene in the middle of the Easter Vigil when the newly baptized come marching for the first time into the nave of the great church, dressed all in their paschal or baptismal whites. Now, why is that significant? It's significant, one, that it's the first time they're allowed in the nave. And second, that they're wearing white. What was white? Besides a kind of obvious symbol of light and purity and all that good stuff.
Priestly color?
It's the priestly color. That's what the priests of the Old Testament wore. They wore unbleached linen. White. It's what the high priest wears, in fact, on Yom Kippur. The only time in the year anybody ever goes into the Holy of Holies, according to Leviticus, he takes off all his high priestly finery and puts on the simple linen of the priest and then enters with the blood of sacrifice for his sins and the sins of Israel. So that says something very important about how the ancient church understood baptism. What happened when you were baptized? In effect, you were ordained. You were dressed in the priestly white. And the nave is the holy place. You know, back in Old Testament days and in the days of the time of Christ, Joe Israel, let alone, Hermione Israel, were not allowed in the temple, ever. Ever. They could, that was only for those who were born into the priestly families, the descendants of Aaron. You could never enter the temple. Once a year, I think it was the Feast of Booths, the Mishnah, the proponents of the Talmud, the Mishnah describes a feast when the doors of the temple were opened and people could walk past them and look in. That's the best you got. You got to look. You didn't get in. But in the... So it was a point that the Christians understood that in the Israel of the Messiah, all are priests. So what's he? Or he. Well, they're stand-ins for me. And I stand in the place of the high priest. Only the high priest is in the Holy of Holies. And they stand in my place. And the high priest is Christ. And the liturgy is one. One liturgy. The liturgy of heaven, in which we participate, as it were, every Sunday, in the sacrifice made once for all.
Yes.
And the bishop, or his stand-in, the presbyter, or priest,
stands in the place of the, stands as image of the great high priest who actually presides and whose service it is, and who acts through them. And the priest, the assembly, the royal, the priestly nation, the royal dwelling, which is the faithful, are gathered in the holy place.
Participating.
So as the centuries go by, I give you that illustration that was from late 4th, early 5th century, Egeria's account. The church gradually shapes itself, the church buildings gradually shape themselves to this theology, as in, for example, the introduction of the dome. Again, the first Christian commentary on a domed church is the Sermon on the Consecration of the Church at Kenishrin in Syria. I'm reading a lot about Syria in the headlines now. Must have been wrong. But remember that Syria is still a country with a very significant Christian presence. And innumerable Christian memorials. Well, this poem, this sermon poem on the consecration of the Church of Kenishrin commemorates it as a dome and brings up specifically the idea of the microcosm. The dome stands for the heavens, and the church building is an image of the redeemed universe. The universe as redeemed in Messiah, Jesus. And so when you go to Greece, and you walk into a kind of, assuming that the church you walk into has a complete iconographical program, not all churches can afford that, especially little village churches. But if you go to, say, the cathedral in Thessaloniki, the cathedral, not just the ancient one, Hagia Sophia, that's not the cathedral, the cathedral is Gregory Palamas, down by the seashore. You look up on the dome, and there's Jesus, looking down from you, looking down at you, and he has the title Pantokrator, in Greek, which means all ruler. This is the Jesus of the Last Judgment. The Jesus who appears to divide the sheep and the goats and to make judgment. And then underneath him, there are angels. In the squinches of the dome, there are the evangelists, either the images of the evangelists themselves, the four of them, or the images of their symbols, who are the lion, the ox, the man, and the eagle. And by the way, anyone know where that image comes from? Lion?
Revelation.
But Revelation is taking it from somewhere. Where is it taking it?
Describe the four gospel writers?
Yes, but where does that image come from? It comes from Ezekiel. From Ezekiel's vision of the chariot throne. The living creatures, who he later identifies as the cherubim, have four faces. The face of the lion, the face of the ox, the face of the man, and the face of the eagle. And Revelation does pick up on. And then these are chosen as images of the gospel writers. Why?
Is it their different styles of rhetoric?
Well.
And their career paths?
They certainly have different styles of rhetoric. Very different. Mark writes terrible Greek. kind of kitchen Greek. Although it doesn't make him less subtle and profound. He is actually the most subtle, I think, of all the gospel writers. it's, it's in reference to the fact that they hold up, that the cherubim in Ezekiel's vision are holding up the throne and the one on the throne. And so the gospel writers, as it were, hold up the Pantocrator. Yes? They carry him. They present him to us. So they're placed in that position, sort of holding up the Pantocrator in the dome. And then below them, there are all the saints.
They're usually ranked, you know, there's martyrs are for apostles, martyrs, confessors, ascetics, monks, unmercenary physicians. Imagine that. Even in the Roman world, a doctor who didn't take money was so rare that they canonized him.
On down to the sort of ruler saints, I think. So that when you walk into this church, you have, as it were, in a single glance, the entire cosmos. Or at least the redeemed cosmos. The macrocosm of the redeemed, the microcosm of the redeemed cosmos. Reminds me, when I taught at Marquette, I taught a course in the Orthodox Church, and one of the assignments that the students had was to go to an Orthodox Sunday service and simply report what they saw. There were some really interesting takes. fun, actually. And the discussion group was always the liveliest session of the semester. But those who were, I had a few Orthodox students. So I asked them, you go to a Western church service and you report what you see. So I had this one Greek kid. And in the discussion session, someone asked him, well, what did you see? And he said, I didn't see anybody. He went to the big Catholic church on campus. He said, I looked around and I said, where is everyone? There was no one there in the walls. No one familiar. Now, I said this has an application in the spiritual life. And again, I go to Syria. Maybe right around the time that Eusebius was writing his sermon on the church in Tyre, an ascetic, we can't call him a monk yet because that word didn't exist anyway in the Aramaic language that they spoke in what's now Iraqi Kurdistan, part of the Persian Empire. We don't know his name. He wrote a book called The Book of Steps. And he's talking to monks in one chapter who are saying, in effect, why do we need to go to church? We pray. Surely Christ is present in prayer. Why do we need all this church stuff? Aha, says our writer. No, no, no. You missed the point, he said. This church, meaning the one on earth, the visible assembly of the Christians that worship in a given place, this is the image of the heavenly church, which was given us by God, Christ. First, Christ speaking to Moses on Sinai, because it's universal ancient Christian understanding that the one who appeared and spoke to the prophets was the second person of the Trinity. And you'll hear that all over the place this coming week in the hymns. He who rides in the cherubim now rides in the bowl of an ass, that sort of thing. On Sunday. Palm Sunday. So, where was I?
Image of the heavenly church?
Image, yes. This church on earth is the image of the heavenly church, and it's there in order for the little church of the heart that is the microcosm which is every human being, to be conformed to the church on high through participation in the worship of the church. And in fact, the ancient Christian writer who Father Marcus mentioned in my introduction, in the introduction to me, Dionysius the Areopagite, another Syrian, there are lots of Syrians in this story right now, another Syrian in the turn of the 6th century says in fact that this liturgy is given to shape its participants, to stamp them with its mark, which is the mark of heaven, to form them. What that's understood as a shaping force. So, in that way, liturgy and prayer, private prayer, or the public life of the church, and the labors of the hermit in his cave, are understood as part of a single thing. This question confronted me. I remember at one point in my stay in Mount Athos. I was standing in the monastery church for this. They were celebrating a big feast, and they really do it up when they have a big feast. They have a literal all-night vigil. And it's very grand. And they polish all their brass, and they light all the candles and all the chandeliers, and there are lots of them. And they set them swinging. So you have this kind of dance of candlelight, an image of the heavenly dance, yes, and the angels. And it's all gold and splendid vestments. They had priestly vestments given from in the time of the tsars from Russia that you could set up housekeeping in. They were so stiff with gold and embroidery. And standing right next to me is this little old monk I knew was a hermit, in a kind of patched cassock. And I knew he didn't have two sticks to rub together. Living down in his shack near the sea. And I looked at him and I thought, what on earth does he see in this? Here's all this Byzantine gorgeousness, dripping gold and brass and silver and splendor. And here's this little guy who's the very antithesis, whose life is all poverty, stripping of every possession and earthly pleasure. What's the connection for him? How is he not even offended by this display? And that question actually was important for my arriving at my reading of Dionysius, Father Marcus. The answer I came to was this. The connection is that he sees in that all that splendor of the liturgy, himself, as he is called to be. Because the Christian is called to be the place of God, yes, the throne of God. This is very common in the ancient ascetical literature. The Christian is called to be temple. St. Paul uses that language. And church, place of the divine presence. And revelation of God to the world. As another ancient Syrian writer puts it, you know, a place of repentance for the sinner. Place of reconciliation. A mercy seat in Elastirion. So the liturgy is illustrative not simply of the life of heaven, finally, but of what we who are Christians are called to be in the Orthodox tradition, and this will be borne out in the architecture. And I think I'm done, right? 7:30.
Yes.
I'm a professional.
Right? Yes.
Well, now it's after hours. Do you have any questions before you pack up and go?
This fits in beautifully with what we've just begun talking about.
Oh, good.
Well, what we will continue to talk about next week.
There's a lot to talk about.
There is.
You did mention that monks are the exemplars of the Christian life. Mm-hmm. We're supposed to ask about that.
Oh, yes. Well, put it this way. Monks and Christians are not two, ordinary, married Christians are not two separate categories of creature. Monasticism is just a concentrated dosage of the Christian life. It's a kind of machine, if you will, the monastery, invented by the church to provide the circumstances for maximal concentration on the things of God. It's not that the monk is different, or should have a different perspective than the Christian who lives in the world with family and children and all that. But that he's can concentrate on it more than some guy or gal who's got all the stuff to worry about that you have to worry about to have a family. It's a different kind of family, but it's a family. As that abbot who tonsured me said to me once, we Christians, he said, we're not supposed to live alone. We're supposed to live in family. And either we create one, that is, get married, or we join one, that is, enter a monastery. But the spirituality, by which I mean the sort of discipline and understanding which shapes the Christian life and the Orthodox world anyway, is the same for monks and for lay. It's not a different one for each. Which is maybe why we don't have orders. Western
connection. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate your coming and speaking to us.
Well, of all things in the university life, I don't miss reading learned papers. I don't miss faculty meetings, although God knows I have enough meetings now of a different sort. But I miss the classroom.
Thank you. Okay. Good roll. See you next week.
Yes. And then I have you.
I have a chance for this.